and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the apparent attempt by the Republican chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee to circumscribe and limit the new FBI inquiry into Judge Kavanaugh to only four witnesses, while President Trump was claiming it was an open and broad investigation. A former 16-year veteran of the FBI, Michael German, now a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program, joins us to discuss how, in an investigation limited to 1 week, already 3 days out of the seven have been lost, and only now that Trump has bowed to pressure from the press to allow FBI agents to follow leads, is the investigation on the right track. We will assess what former director of the FBI James Comey meant in an op-ed in the New York Times when he referred to limits on the investigation as idiotic, and explore what evidence could be gathered to support the accusations made by Dr. Christine Blasey Ford in terms of finding the location of the alleged sexual assault and the bedroom and bathroom she described. And since, as the Republicans keep reminding us, that Kavanaugh has already had six FBI investigations, we'll look into whether there is corroborating evidence in past inquiries that was either overlooked or not followed up on. Then we'll discuss today's blow to right-wing conspiracy theorists with the right-wing Washington Times apologizing for a story they have retracted that falsely claimed a staffer with the DNC, Seth Rich, who was murdered in a botched robbery in a Washington suburb in July of 2016, was a part of a conspiracy involving his brother Aaron, who supposedly received money from WikiLeaks for the hacked DNC emails. Mark Fenster, a professor at the Levin College of Law at the University of Florida and author of Conspiracy Theories, Secrecy and Power in American Culture, joins us to discuss how Sean Hannity, Fox News, Sean Spicer, and President Trump all pushed this absurd and cruel conspiracy theory to distract from the meddling by Russia in the 2016 election. Then finally, we will speak with Jamie Court, the president of Consumer Watchdog, a consumer group that has been fighting corrupt corporations and crooked politicians since 1985. He joins us to discuss the bill California's governor signed on Sunday night to strengthen protections against abuses by internet providers, which immediately provoked an injunction from the Department of Justice, putting California officially at war with the federal government over net neutrality. We will discuss how AT&T slowed down internet service to fire departments who were in the midst of fighting California's wildfires because the new FCC rules allow them to speed up or slow down service depending on how much customers can afford to pay. And joining us now is Michael German, a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program, where his work focuses on law enforcement and intelligence oversight and reform. Previously, he served as the Policy Counsel for National Security and Privacy for the American Civil Liberties Union, Washington Legislative Office, and he's the 16-year veteran of federal law enforcement, having served as a special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where he specialized in domestic terrorism and covert operations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael German.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Mike. And what do you make of criticism on the part of a number of Senate Democrats saying that the FBI inquiry or the final inquiry into Judge Kavanaugh following the hearings that was largely engineered by the combination of Senator Coons and Senator Flake, that it's being somehow limited and circumscribed in spite of repeated pronouncements by President Trump that it's wide open and they're going to go wherever the evidence leads them. So how do you come down on this?
So it's quite troubling that the White House, or whether the president is correct that these restrictions came from the Senate Judiciary Committee, in either event, the idea that the FBI could only conduct a handful of interviews and not follow other leads is quite troubling. Particularly because it was a very short time period that was allowed. So the fact that even if more recent reports are now correct that these restrictions have been lifted, we've lost a number of days in a very short time period that could have been useful for chasing other leads. And one other number of people have reported that the FBI would not accept voluntarily provided statements from other witnesses. In other words, witnesses who were calling their local FBI office to offer information were being turned away. And that is even more troubling to me because, you know, typically the FBI is in the information business and is happy to accept voluntary information from anyone who would provide it. And often that is unreliable and not helpful, but you wouldn't turn that down in any event. So the fact, or at least the allegation, that the FBI field offices were turning away witnesses is quite troubling.
So let's try and figure out how this inquiry got circumscribed by the Judiciary Committee, and what would have been the bureaucratic steps? Senator Grassley would have written up the letter with the restrictions and then sent it to Don McGahn. He would have signed off on it, and then the president would have signed off on it. Is that how it would work?
It's really hard to tell. Certainly the FBI would get its marching orders directly from the White House rather than from the committee. Usually the members of Congress don't order the FBI to do something. So clearly whatever direction the FBI got came from the White House. But whether that was a written request or a request that was fielded from members of Congress, I think we'll have to wait until we see the document trail on how this happened.
So,
but in any event, it certainly undermines the integrity of the investigation. And in a matter as important as this, I think has done grave damage. No matter which way the investigation turns out, there are going to be people who believe that it was politicized and came to a political result.
And how many days do you think we've lost in terms of, if it's true, that now these restrictions have been taken off and the FBI is able to go out and follow the leads wherever they might take them? For example, one potential witness, Elizabeth Razor, who's a former girlfriend of Kavanaugh's high school friend, Mark Judge, she has been sort of screaming to the rafters, saying she's called the Senate Judiciary Committee and the FBI, and she's asked for an opportunity to speak to them, but she's had no response. So she's an example of somebody that they would now talk to several days later?
I would hope so. And again, this seems to be a separate issue, because one of the things when people were concerned about the week-long investigation that was being allowed, the short term of that, one of the mitigating issues to my mind was that any time there is an issue of national concern being discussed in the media, people call the FBI. I mean, we've seen in this case how many people reached out to the media. Well, most people don't like being publicly identified, but if they have information they think the government needs to know, they'll pick up the phone and call the FBI because they know the FBI can protect their identity and conduct the investigation. And if the FBI has actually been turning away witnesses this whole time, that has deprived them of a lot of information that could have proved useful in this very truncated time period that will be hard to recreate at this point.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael German, who's a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program, where his work focuses on law enforcement and intelligence oversight and reform. And previously he served as a policy counsel for national security and privacy for the American Civil Liberties Union, Washington Legislative Office. And he's a 16-year veteran of federal law enforcement, having served as a special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where he specialized in domestic terrorism and covert operations. So, Mike, what did you make of Director Comey's, or former Director, FBI Director Comey's op-ed in the New York Times today? He's basically saying that this one-week circumscribed inquiry is idiotic, is the word that he used.
You know, again, I assumed that over the last 6 or 8 weeks, the FBI has been fielding numerous calls, and whether or not they were actually chasing them down or just recording the witness statements and putting them in the file would have been very helpful. You know, to hear at this late stage that the FBI was turning them away troubles me, both because it hints that there was some kind of directive that went out throughout the FBI not to accept information about this nominee, which again highlights the politicization of the matter. But also, just now that we do have an investigation, the ability to go back and recreate that all those witness statements in such a short period of time and follow up on any leads that might develop is going to be much more difficult to pull down, particularly because any reluctant witnesses only have to hide out for a few days at this point. It's already difficult to find somebody and find an available time period to send an agent to their house to interview them. But if somebody was trying not to participate in the investigation or not to provide information, laying low for a week isn't that hard.
So nobody seems to have gotten a copy of Grassley's letter to the White House circumscribing this investigation and naming just a handful of witnesses or that they've approved for the FBI to interview. That, in retrospect, and from what you've told us, does appear to be a deliberate sabotage. Is that too strong a way to describe it?
It certainly undermines the integrity of the investigation. I mean, an investigation, by definition, is open-ended and follows the facts and the leads as they come. I mean, particularly with a background investigation, there's already a format for that where there are specific issues that are supposed to be addressed, and one of those includes potential bias of the nominee and the other potential alcohol abuse and drug abuse. So, these are issues that should have been brought up in any background investigation and any attempt to limit inquiries into those areas that are part of the normal process would undermine the integrity and the effectiveness of the investigation.
Well, there is somebody apparently that has been interviewed. At least he's made a sufficient amount of a fuss. He's a professor, Charles Luddington. I think he's in North Carolina. He said that he was a classmate of Kavanaugh's at Yale and said that he'd seen Judge Kavanaugh slurring his words and staggering after excessive alcohol consumption while at Yale. He's contradicted by a basketball player who says the opposite. So put yourself back in your days at the FBI, Mike German. How do you navigate through that? Do you just do these 302s and just give the customer, in this case the United States Senate, I think every senator is going to be getting this dossier, you just give them what you got and let them make up their minds?
Right. A background investigation is not a criminal investigation, so the agents aren't trying to prove facts beyond a reasonable doubt. The purpose of the background investigation is to give the people who are nominating the person and the people who are approving that nomination in Congress information from which they can make a educated determination of whether that person is fit for the job they're being nominated to. So anytime there's derogatory information, that's something that they need to know about. And typically this is done before we get into hearings and before a person is actually selected. So, I mean, this is a bit of a black eye for the FBI that they have done previous background investigations and potentially didn't find this stuff. Now, it very well may be that, in fact, there were allegations in these previous background packets, but for whatever reason, the people nominating him to the positions and the people approving it in Congress didn't see fit to raise those issues. Again, that'll be hard to find out late, especially if this person gets voted into a seat in the highest court with a lifetime appointment. And I think that's the danger we have here for the integrity of the process, that unless we have a full and fair investigation to root out all these questions that the public now knows are out there, what's going to happen when new allegations come forward the week later and perhaps information about the nominee's truthfulness during testimony or, we also still have all the records or many of the records from his previous government service at the White House that haven't been revealed. So if more documents come out, more witnesses come forward that reveal that there was some shading of the truth during the hearings, I think that will create a much larger problem down the road. So truncating this investigation is very short-sighted.
But you mentioned, and it's been mentioned many, many times by the Republican defenders of Judge Kavanaugh, who said, you know, he said already had six FBI background checks, so why do we need to do this one? Now that they've agreed reluctantly or been forced into it by Jeff Flake, can they go back and look through all of those files to see, in fact, whether there were some allegations about, say, heavy drinking or something else that wasn't considered inflammatory enough back then, but now in the light of much of what's transpired over the last week, they would seem to be relevant now.
Absolutely, and I would imagine that the FBI has been going back through those records as these revelations have come to the public to find out what they missed, because this is something that should have been part of an earlier vetting process. And a determination made one way or another. And it may be that there were allegations, again, that the FBI properly documented, but the people who made the decision to nominate and approve that nomination viewed that information as not pertinent. But now, of course, with these more serious allegations, I think they'll rethink how those previous background investigations didn't uncover this kind of material.
Well, in James Comey's op-ed in Monday's New York Times, on the one hand, he thinks that the way that this inquiry has been circumscribed is, as I mentioned, he used the word idiotic. But at the same time, he pointed out that this is what the FBI does, so just let them do it. I guess there's no way that Comey has much influence over the White House, right? So what made them change their mind?
Clearly the amount of coverage that the attempt to narrow the investigation has received in the media and the members of Congress whose vote depends on the thoroughness of these investigations apparently has seemed to drive a change of course here. But again, we're 3 days into what was going to be a 7-day investigation, so that time has been lost, and when you have such a short time period, losing that much of it is going to be detrimental to the quality of the investigation that can proceed. And again, I was working under the notion that all through the last several weeks, people were coming forward to the FBI, and the FBI was collecting that information. So a lot of what this 7 days would be collating the information that they had already received and evaluating it. But if they have, if the reports are correct, that they've been turning away these witnesses and not taking statements, voluntary statements from witnesses, that's quite troubling.
So I mentioned this Professor Luddington, who is a Yale classmate of Brett Kavanaugh's, and he made a statement to the New York Times, I think it was, just quoting it, "When Brett got drunk, he was belligerent and aggressive. On one of the last occasions I purposely socialized with Brett, I witnessed him respond to a semi-hostile remark, not by defusing the situation, but by throwing his beer in the man's face and starting a fight that ended up with one of our mutual friends in jail." So that sounds like an incident that would have had witnesses, not to mention a police record.
Right. So again, an incident like that on its own, 30-some years ago, probably wouldn't have a lot of impact on deciding whether somebody can be a White House counselor or a circuit judge. It's very possible that the FBI did document that kind of an allegation, but it just wasn't deemed as disqualifying. I think a lot of what they're looking at now on its face would not necessarily have been disqualifying, but what we have is a situation where in sworn testimony, the nominee has disputed this. And in addition to other issues that around his work as White House counsel in the enhanced interrogation torture program and warrantless wiretapping, working on certain judicial nominees, there's a question about his truthfulness during previous confirmation hearings. So the issue is more about his truthfulness now rather than how much he did or didn't drink then.
So just to wrap this up then, going back to the original request by the Senate Judiciary Committee, by Chairman Grassley, to the White House for this limited FBI investigation. Apparently, they only listed four people for the FBI to question: Mark Judge, P.J. Smythe, who's a high school friend of Judge's and Kavanaugh's, and Leland Kaiser, who's a high school friend of the accuser, Christine Blasey Ford, and Deborah Ramirez, the woman at Yale who made the second accusation. The third accuser, is represented by the lawyer Michael Avenatti, is not even right. being taken seriously, which seems sort of somewhat arbitrary. But let's just focus on what the FBI would do with what they were given just before, you know, in the limited version, albeit the three wasted days, if you could call it that. Would they then try and find this house? Would they try and find the bedroom, the bathroom, everything that Blasey Ford talked about? Would that be their mandate?
Certainly, if these limitations were not placed on the FBI, that would be the type of corroborating evidence they would seek. But even more importantly than that, in doing a background investigation, typically you start with a number of references that the nominee himself or herself has given to the FBI. But the goal of the investigation is to go a layer or two beneath that. So the last question you ask every witness you interview is, who else should I be talking to? Because oftentimes you have a witness who might have heard a story secondhand or third hand and not feel comfortable basically spreading a rumor to the FBI, but when asked that question, who else should I talk to, might refer the FBI to somebody who is closer to the truth of that other story, and that's where typically you'll find the information that a nominee would rather have kept hidden.
Well, just in closing, a lot of people have pointed out that when Kavanaugh was questioned about his yearbook, in those hearings last week that were obviously very contentious, it did seem like he was just lying in a way that was sort of silly, I thought, about, you know, references to the Devil's Triangle and all these other things, which he tried to deflect. I think everybody pretty much knows what that teenage coded language was about, don't they?
I think that's right, and I think even more troubling, I don't think he did himself any favors by being so partisan in his criticism, because again, one of the issues that the FBI is supposed to delve into in doing these background investigations is any bias. So, you know, to the extent there is partisan bias on somebody who is going to be elevated to the highest court, that's something that the people who are determining his fitness for that position should be evaluating.
Well, Michael German, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael German, who's a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program, where his work focuses on law enforcement and intelligence oversight and reform. Previously served as the policy counsel for national security and privacy for the American Civil Liberties Union, Washington Legislative Office, and after he's a 16-year veteran of federal law enforcement, having served as a special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where he specialized in domestic terrorism and covert operations. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about today's blow to right-wing conspiracy theorists with the right-wing Washington Times apologizing for a conspiracy theory involving a DNC staffer who was murdered in a botched robbery in a Washington suburb in July of 2016.
That you want me to do? Yes, you have, girl. Don't you know you got to tell the truth, yeah? Baby, why don't you tell me the truth?
Bruce Brother!
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck!
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul!
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J!
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu!
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin!
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich!
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith!
Sit down, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mark Fenster, professor at the Levin College of Law at the University of Florida, whose research focuses on government transparency, legal intellectual history, and constitutional limits on governing regulations. He is the author of The Transparency Fix, Secrets, Leaks, and Uncontrollable Government Information, and Conspiracy Theories, Secrecy and Power in American Culture. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Fenster.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And there was a blow to right-wing conspiracy theorists today with the Washington Times apologizing for a since-deleted article that falsely claimed that Seth Rich, who was a staffer with the Democratic National Committee, who was murdered in a suburb of Washington in July of 2016, his brother, they said, was actually paid by WikiLeaks for the DNC emails. So it was an attempt by those defenders of President Trump to come up with an alternative scenario to the one that the intelligence agencies have come up with, which is that the Russian military intelligence, GRU, hacked the DNC, turned over the material to WikiLeaks, and WikiLeaks dumped it on the eve of the Democratic convention. So how do you see this retraction in the Washington Times?
Well, I would say that it's the very least that they could do. It wasn't very much, and it came very late. And it required a lawsuit to accomplish, but at least it was something.
So the family, I mean, this is it's punishment enough to lose your son to apparently a botched random murder on the streets of Washington, D.C. And as far as I know, they've never caught anybody for this murder, have they? Which sort of...
No, that's correct. It remains this sort of anomalous, although in many big cities, you know, murders go unsolved. It's somewhat rare that a, you know, relatively wealthy white person's murder doesn't get solved, but this one has not been solved.
So the parents have suffered enough, and now, of course, since his murder, all of these right-wing conspiracy theorists have seized on this scenario, and it's been shared widely on Fox News, and it must have reached President Trump because he ordered Pompeo, when he was the head of the CIA, to meet with this ex-NSA guy, William Binney, who was also promoting the same theory. And Pompeo apparently met with Binney. So is there a kind of loop going on here? Because also Sean Hannity really was one of the main drumbeats for this particular Seth Rich conspiracy theory.
Right. Well, it was very much part of the Republican Party's efforts to try to deflect all attention from any sort of Russian interference in the election. And so, you know, any sort of trial balloon that could occur that could be thrown up to try to deflect that attention was useful. And, you know, even Assange at one point and his, you know, sort of weird friend in the shadows, Kim.com, played some role in saying, well, it could have been Seth Rich who did this. And Kim.com suggested that it was Seth Rich. And, of course, you know, as we know, Assange had some role in at least the distribution of hacked emails. So everyone was looking for some convenient way to deflect attention from either what they knew or what they, you know, rather closely suspected about Russian involvement. And here's this anomalous murder that other people are talking about, and how convenient, and, you know, the sort of leading edge of conspiracy theorists are working on, and how convenient to sort of bring some attention to it.
Well, Sean Hannity of Fox News, even after Seth Rich's parents had written to the Washington Post an opinion piece talking about that ordeal and asking for this rumor mongering to stop, adding to the pain of losing their son, that nevertheless didn't seem to slow down Sean Hannity at all.
No, it finally took Fox News to, you know, at least step back from the extent to which they were promoting it. And clearly that must have led Hannity to, even if he was not, even if parts of him wanted to continue to pursue it, he seemed to have agreed not to pursue it any further, leaving open the possibility of coming back to it later, but he never has come back to it later. And in the meantime, you know, Mueller has filed indictments against Russian individuals and Russian institutions for, in fact, doing the very things that Seth Rich was alleged to have done in these conspiracy theories.
And in the particular settlement retraction today is about the conspiracy theory that Seth Rich's brother received money from WikiLeaks for these hacked DNC emails. It's worth noting that the server for WikiLeaks is in Russia, and a foreign operation does not have a server based in Russia that the Russian intelligence services don't know about, if not control.
Right. And, you know, the suggestion Seth Rich's brother had something to do with it, based upon absolutely no evidence whatsoever, merely just spinning a lot of hooey out of thin air, is particularly egregious.
So apparently the Seth Rich conspiracy theory, in short, alleges that Seth Rich was a supporter of Senator Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign and that he released the DNC emails after Sanders lost the Democratic nomination. And, of course, the reality was that WikiLeaks dumped the DNC internal information, much of which was critical of Bernie Sanders and showed a bias in the DNC towards Hillary Clinton. That was clearly targeted at dividing the Democrats on the eve of their convention, was it not? I mean, so obvious.
Right. It seems to be, and WikiLeaks seems to have been a willing cutout for the dumping of that information. So, yes, it does seem that way. What we know for sure, of course, this hasn't been proven, though the allegations in the indictment seem well supported, as indictments sometimes are. But what's clear is that Seth Rich had nothing to do with it.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Fenster, who's a professor at the Levin College of Law at the University of Florida, whose research focuses on government transparency, legal intellectual history, and constitutional limits on government regulations. He's the author of The Transparency Fix, Secrets, Leaks, and Uncontrollable Government Information, and Conspiracy Theories, Secrecy and Power in American Culture. So the statement today from Aaron Rich reads as follows. The last 2 years have brought unimaginable pain and grief to my family and me. I lost my only brother to a murder that to this date has not been solved, only to then have politically motivated conspiracy theorists falsely accuse me of grotesque criminal acts. I accept the Washington Times' retraction and apology, and am grateful that the Washington Times has acknowledged the indisputable truth that these allegations are and always have been false. As to the remaining defendants, I look forward to my day in court. So who are the other defendants, Mark, do you know?
The other defendants were individuals who played a more direct role in circulating the conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm.
There was a particular wealthy individual who attempted to gin up interest in it, to hire a private investigator, to do other things in order to attempt to develop these theories and circulate them within the public.
So is that the retired D.C. detective Rod Wheeler and this fellow Butowski, a conservative pundit?
Right, yeah, no, and Wheeler seems to have defected from the cause. I mean, he seems to have suggested that he was in some ways a dupe. He was merely a hired gun and was fed information that was incorrect. I don't think he's a defendant. In fact, I think he had his own separate lawsuit that he filed, which was dismissed ultimately.
Right. So Edward Butowski, there's another right-wing activist, Matthew Crouch, or Couch, I should say, with America First Media. But I think, didn't Fox also have to retract? Didn't they have a former Navy admiral on who got fired for pushing this conspiracy?
I know they retracted a story that was on their website, and they basically did, without doing it quite as explicitly as the Washington Times did, shut down discussion of the conspiracy theories on their network, both television and radio. I think it's now. I don't think you see anything more about it or hear anything more about it. It's moved instead to the margins, as opposed to in you know, curiously, the mainstream of right-wing media discourse.
But nevertheless,
The Washington Times is itself fairly marginal at this point, but it, compared to the remaining defendants, the Washington Times would at one time have claimed to be a serious journalistic enterprise. I don't think even today they could continue to make that claim. But so much of the right-wing media sphere is, you know, you've got Fox News, but then you've got all of these various websites with various levels of capitalization and various connections with the far right. And you don't see quite as much on Seth Rich anymore. I mean, in some ways, this is the efforts by the family to both in terms of litigation, in terms of being up front, has had a significant effect in ways that I think, you know, it was relatively new in the world of conspiracy theories, where both the targeting of individuals and innocent individuals has occurred before, but it seems to go to a greater extent now. But the efforts by individuals to fight back, and you see this with Sandy Hook too, seems to have gotten some degree of purchase in ways that, you know, I don't think you would have seen before.
But nevertheless, Wheeler and Butowski, who were pushing this Seth Rich conspiracy theory, they actually met in the White House with the press secretary, Sean Spicer, to brief Spicer in the White House on this fraudulent story. So they did pretty well with it, didn't they?
They did. Yeah. No, there is no doubt. I mean, you know, my giving you the sunny side now was the result of, you know, 2 years of efforts by the Rich family to fight against this.
Right.
And has been, notwithstanding the, you know, bizarro world that we live in which the White House has been willing to, you know, play footsie with conspiracy theorists explicitly and with, you know, serious conspiracy theorists, and to float conspiracy theories in ways that, you know, you would not have seen, certainly in the last 50 years, coming from the White House.
Well, at times it feels like Donald Trump is channeling Alex Jones. I mean, he was on Alex Jones on his show when he was running as a candidate and praised him. I think they may have accredited some people from Alex Jones as InfoWars to the White House. I'm not sure whether that – I know they'd applied for credentials.
I mean, if it wasn't directly from InfoWars, there are plenty of other pundits. I mean, there are plenty of other outlets like Gateway Pundit, which itself also circulates conspiracy theories, which was credentialed. So, absolutely. I mean, I think – Trump's brilliance, if you could call it that, has been in identifying particular niches of demographics and individuals who would be willing to contemplate the kinds of things that he says and does. And, you know, if you think about it, Alex Jones's audience is young white men who are generally not affiliated with political parties, were largely alienated from politics. Many of whom lived in the Midwest and continue to live in the Midwest. And, you know, if you think of us as a hardened red versus blue world, here is a small but identifiable group of people who have no clear identification going red or blue. And he was able to, you know, sway them to believe that he was on their side. I don't think there's any way to know whether that won him the election, but it certainly, you know, if 50,000-60,000 votes in various Midwestern states could have swayed the election, he might have been able to identify, you know, when among Alex Jones's viewers and listeners, precisely that number.
Well, I noticed the other day at the White House press conference, I think it was with the Polish president, the first question was a softball question asked to a blonde woman from a conspiracy website out of San Diego. So, right. You know, he's using these people as, you know, if not to spread conspiracy theories, at least to throw softball questions to him.
Yes, and they, you know, they are certainly capable of doing that.
So just in the last couple of minutes, you know, Alex Jones was one of the people who started the 9/11 truther conspiracy. He produced a movie called Loose Change, which
he didn't have any. You are absolutely correct that he was very involved in the 9/11 stuff, but he wasn't. I'm pretty sure that he was not directly affiliated with the Loose Change movie.
He has a credit on it as a producer.
Oh, really? Well,
yeah.
Okay.
Well,
but I don't think he was. Well, that's a subject for another day.
Yeah,
but yes.
But the point I wanted to bring up was that, you know, I find those kind of conspiracy theories really offensive, because in the real world, intentions determine outcomes. Outcomes don't determine intentions. So it's easy to trace things back from the outcome to create a conspiracy. In other words, 9/11 rescued the sort of flagging presidency of George Bush and Dick Cheney. But because it sort of reinvented and revived their presidency, that doesn't mean these two organized it in order to do that. You know what I'm saying?
It would be quite a masterstroke.
Right, exactly.
Two people who demonstrated a real lack of masterstrokeness for much of the rest of their presidency.
Right. But then when, you know, I used to get attacked by these people all the time, and it's sort of, they have a cult-like intensity about their beliefs, you know, and they said, well, you know, the plane didn't really crash into the Pentagon and into the towers. That was some Air Force plane. And I said, well, what happened to the people on the American Airlines plane? And they said, oh, it was taken to an airfield, undisclosed location, and all the passengers were shot and buried in a mass grave by the government. And I thought to myself, well, do you have any idea of what a cruel thing that is to the families who lost people, one of whom I knew on that first plane?
Right.
You know, I mean, again, it goes back to the rich family. You know, you suffer a terrible tragedy, and then these people, like sort of ghouls and parasites, make a sort of living out of opening your wound.
Right, right. No, and I mean, Sandy Hook isn't even... I don't want to compare the wounds, but it is another example of the awfulness of it. It is, you know, conspiracy theories are fun to speculate about. They are fun to read novels, to read things that are exciting accounts of what otherwise seems like a banal and meaningless world. But there are victims. And, you know, the Seth Rich story is clearly a demonstration of that.
Well, Mark Fenster, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Fenster, who's a professor at the Levin College of Law at the University of Florida, whose research focuses on government transparency, legal intellectual history, and constitutional limits on government regulation. He's the author of The Transparency Fix, Secrets, Leaks, and Uncontrollable Government Information, and Conspiracy Theories, Secrecy and Power in American Culture. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the bill California's governor signed on Sunday night to strengthen protections against abuses by Internet providers, which immediately provoked an injunction from the Department of Justice, putting California officially at war with the federal government over net neutrality. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jamie Court, who's the president of Consumer Watchdog, a consumer group that has been fighting corrupt corporations and crooked politicians since 1985. He's a co-author of Making Killing, HMOs and the Threat to Your Health, and The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change You Voted For, a Direct Democracy Toolkit. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jamie Court.
Thanks, Ian. Great to be back.
And on Sunday evening, Governor Jerry Brown of California signed a bill that involves the strongest protections against abuses by internet providers in the country, in effect overturning the FCC's net neutrality decision. And other states have done so, Vermont, Oregon, and Washington, although California's law is a much stronger one. But immediately, the federal government, the FCC, filed an injunction. So the law would not come into effect until January 2019. But what do you expect is going to happen in the meantime? At this point, where do we stand?
Well, it's up to the courts. And, you know, there's good law on both sides. I mean, you know, California is the fifth largest economy in the world. These companies are based here. We have a right to say, with our own cell phone carriers, you know, this is the AT&T's, the Verizon's, the T-Mobile's, that the Sprint's, these companies want to do business with Californians. They are regulated as cellular phone companies under our Public Utility Commission. And we have the right to tell them you can't throttle back internet speeds because someone's not paying you enough or they're not a big enough company. And what happened to really inspire this bill forth, because it was stuck, AT&T and the other telecoms had a real grab on it in the state capitol, and they had it in place. And then we had some wildfires out here. And as you recall, there was just this tremendously outrageous incident where Verizon throttled back the internet speed of a fire department fighting one of these blazes, and they couldn't communicate with each other because they had throttled back the speed of the fire company, and then they claim, well, they've used over their allotment of gigabytes, and therefore we got to pull back their speeds. Well, that was a public health and public safety emergency that Verizon hadn't thought about or planned for or cared about. And I think those facts are going to be really important when we go to court, because you know, if we can't fight fires in the state of California because these private companies that want to do business here have the right to slow down our internet speeds, that creates a real public threat. There is a compelling state interest in this type of regulation. Now, on the other hand, the Trump and the Federal Communication Commission and the Federal Trade Commission are going to say, look, this is our jurisdiction. There's interstate commerce, and if one state starts to have one rule for telecom companies and the other state has another rule, how are we going to have interstate commerce? So that's how justice will weigh this. I tend to believe that because of the circumstances with the fire department being the victim here, that if this is well argued and lawyers do what they should do, that this law may hold.
Well, if they could do this in California, the big telecoms like AT&T and Verizon, who pushed for the net neutrality bill to overturn net neutrality under Ajit Pai, the new and current head of the FCC, then what you described that happened in California, where the fire department, its internet access was slowed down because it had reached its limit, regardless of how important it was at the moment for this fire department to be fighting one of these worst forest fires in the history of California. That situation is writ large across the country as we speak, right? It's only that California is trying to do something about it along with Vermont, Washington, and Oregon.
Yeah, no, this is the state of play. And what happens is if you exceed you know, a 5 gigabyte usage on your cell phone as an individual, that's when your speeds start to get slow. And the companies that had grandfathered in unlimited data, they throttle back too at higher levels, even though they're supposed to do unlimited data. So it's a real issue. It's a real communications issue. And in times like, you know, wildfire, when we're having them with greater severity, they break out suddenly, and you've got to move. We've got to have the type of regulation that doesn't discriminate between you know, people who overuse data or people who pay more to have extra bandwidth. And we had these regulations on the book very shortly during the Obama era. And they proved to be, you know, really important. I mean, this was, I heard the FCC vote on this when Chairman Wheeler enacted the rules before President Trump, FCC invalidated them. And this was like a civil rights moment. The Democratic FCC commissioners really joined hands. And along with the rules, by the way, for net neutrality in terms of internet speeds, there was also some privacy rules that applied to the telecom carriers, AT&T and others, and required that they actually had to respect our privacy over the pipes and not sell our data without personal identification data without our permission, which they had done before. So this was a real federal moment, and Trump gave a huge gift to the telecoms by reversing it. The consequences were felt dramatically here. That freed this bill. Governor Brown signed it. Our Attorney General Javier Becerra is ready to go to war to fight for it, so he'll put his best legal talents on this, which is really important because sometimes you will lose a lawsuit like this if the attorney generals aren't up to snuff, and sometimes the state attorney generals, frankly, aren't your A team. But in this case, it will have our A team, and I think it's going to send a signal all around America, because if California gets net neutrality, people in New York are going to wonder why they don't have it, and these public safety issues are going to be issues that, you know, come into effect in other places as well. Now, I imagine the telecoms will say, no, no, to learn our lesson, we're now going to make special circumstances for fire departments, police departments, you know, but nonetheless, the point is made. You never know what kind of circumstances are going to come up. So I think this battle in the courts isn't just going to be about whether our California law stands. It's going to be about whether New York will get to enact the law, and Texas will get to enact the law, and other states of significant size will get to enact their own laws. And, I do think, you know, on the legal doctrine, there's cogent arguments to be made on both sides. But I think the political climate here with the wildfires, and I think the fact that this is really one of those issues that actually could be salient in 2020's presidential election, there's going to be a lot of eyes on this. I tend to believe that the state law is going to hold just because it's going to be such a watch case. And if it goes the wrong way, and if it goes the wrong way before the 2020 election, you know, it actually creates really interesting political dynamics that I don't think the courts are going to want.
And again, I'm speaking with Jamie Court, who's the president of Consumer Watchdog, a consumer group that has been fighting corrupt corporations and crooked politicians since 1985. He's the co-author of Making a Killing, HMOs and the Threat to Your Health, and The Progressive Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change You Voted For, a Direct Democracy Toolkit. So when the Obama era net neutrality bill was in force, and then immediately Trump threw Ajit Pai, his appointee, to the FCC, turned just, of course, Trump has basically eviscerated everything that Obama's had, and it seems almost predictable and vindictive on his part. But at the time when Ajit Pai was about to basically kill net neutrality, there was an enormous outpouring from the public. I mean, this is a real case where they just ignored the majority of the people in order to satisfy a powerful special interest minority.
Yes, I think this is a case where the ruling telecom companies be damned. It got what they wanted, and they said the people be damned, and they said, you know, let them have slow internet speeds. It's the modern day equivalent of let them eat cake. And it's something that I think is a telling example of the differences between the Democrats and the Republicans. You know, this is going to be one of the pocketbook consumer issues for which I think Trump administration will always be remembered, and which this FCC and will always be remembered. You know, this is not normal. In European countries, they don't have these problems. In other countries, they do not have these problems. But in America, we suddenly have an election and we lose internet speeds. I think that any 2020 Democratic presidential candidate who doesn't put this at the top of the list of populist grievances against the ruling aristocracy under Trump would be committing political malpractice. So I think this is going to be front and center. And frankly, this case is going to keep it front and center.
But already in the California election, you'd think that the Republicans would be dead on arrival. because the Trump administration, in its so-called big budget reform, where they gave $1.5 trillion to the super rich and hosed everybody else, as a consequence of that, in order to balance the books, which they clearly didn't, they're adding to the deficit enormously, they nevertheless basically punished California by taking away Californians' deduction of state and local taxes on their federal income tax. So it was pure political spite that a successful blue state should be punished by these kind of redneck rural states that are a bunch of parasites. But that's what they did, and yet you've got Republicans running, accusing Democrats of raising your taxes, and they put this gas tax bill on the ballot, hoping to bring out their people to the vote. So what does this say about the people of California? I mean, are they smart enough to know that it's the Republicans who caused them to pay more in taxes and that they're just using this gas tax initiative as a political screen to obscure the fact that they're the ones who really stiffed us?
Yeah, I think that in these six Republican congressional districts, it will be a transformative issue the way California's been targeted, although people tend to vote for their local congressmen. Some of these issues are bigger. But I think this is a bigger issue than California in 2020. The Democrats here have laid down the gauntlet and said, look, if we get back in office, look what they're doing in California, look what Obama did, we're going to do it again. We're going to make sure your internet speed's not slow. And if I were, and I'm not, a Democratic consultant, I guarantee you one of the top five issues I would put on the 2020 agenda for Democrats is the idea that we are not going to allow the telecoms to slow down on our internet speed. Now, the ironic caveat of that, again, is there every year is something called the Speaker's Cup, hosted by AT&T, that the Assembly Speaker in California hosts at Pebble Beach. It's paid for by AT&T, and all their friends come and contribute. So, ironically, AT&T's had a pretty good holdout here, along with the other telecoms. It's just the moment that's transcended all of it. And I think that's going to carry forth and give the Democrats a playbook nationally. If I'm Bernie Sanders, if I'm Elizabeth Warren, if I'm Kamala Harris, believe me, this is going to be one of the top five issues. And they had the courage to do it. Of course, the money trail leads back to the Democrats, too, from the telecoms. But we've got it on the record. The Trump administration suing over it. This is going to be a narrative that plays out. And what's going to hang in the balance is, how quick a connection you're going to have. I don't think this court case is going to be resolved before the 2020 election.
Well, Jamie Court, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Jamie Court, who's the president of Consumer Watchdog, a consumer group that has been fighting corrupt corporations and crooked politicians since 1985. He's the co-author of Making a Killing, HMOs and the Threat to Your Health. And his latest book is The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change You Voted For, a Direct Democracy Toolkit. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.